Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Hi, everyone. Today, it is my pleasure to interview Tyler Barron about steps that founders should take to build and scale SaaS revenue. Tyler is a revenue executive, sales leader for SaaS companies, advisor, coach, and mentor. Tyler helps startups and early growth tech companies scale, accelerate revenue through process optimization, playbook development, and fractional executive services. Welcome to the show, Tyler.
Hey, Natalie. Thank you so much for having me. I've been really looking forward to this.
Tyler and I met a few weeks ago. We are both based in Dallas, Texas, and I was immediately impressed how extremely knowledgeable he is, very sharp, and I'm just sure that he'll be dropping lots of value bombs here today. I'm very excited about the conversation.
Well, I feel like the bar has probably been set too high, but would be glad to share any insight or more, you know, probably better describe just, you know, some of the really tough lessons learned I've picked up throughout the years.
So tell us, how did you get started working with SaaS companies?
Yeah, so, you know, really got into working with early growth SaaS companies after I left my past company. You know, took them through a pretty nice journey of coming on, you know, launching a product and bringing them through initial scale and growing a team out, you know, on the sales side to about 18 reps. And after I left there, I started kind of thinking about what I was going to do next. And, you know, here in Dallas, started talking a lot with founders. You know, most of them were wanting to make their first sales hire, and you sit and chat with them for a little bit, ask a few key questions around, you know, talk to me about, you know, how people buy this, you know, what does the buyer's journey look like, talk to me about where demand's coming from, and you kind of get some odd answers that you start to tell that they really haven't thought about those things, and that really started for me to prompt, like, you know, hey, I think there's an opportunity here for some coaching to where, you know, there's definitely a gap between some really great product founders and what do they need to do next in order to turn this into a legitimate business and get the revenue side of things cranking. So, you know, I started talking with them. I said, hey, you know, before you just hire a first sales rep and more or less set that person up for failure, you actually need a system at which you can really start to pattern things, measure the wins and losses. So the wins become repeatable and then you can just avoid the losses in the future and ultimately do this in a way at which whenever you do hire that first salesperson, they can come in and actually be successful. And, you know, a lot of founders think that sales can kind of be compartmentalized and just say, hey, you know, got a great product, go out and sell it. But it doesn't necessarily really work that way. You know, a model needs to be engineered. So a lot of those conversations kind of prompted me getting into consulting by accident to where I said, hey, look, you know, we really need a model, a playbook, strategy first. Got into doing that just purely out of passion.
So the topic today is steps how SaaS founders can build and scale their revenue. And you're right, that's something that we don't talk about enough in the SaaS community. Everyone's talking about hiring developers, you know, getting their MVP ready, getting traction, adding features, even getting demos and more trials, which is all great. But not a lot of founders talk about how getting those clients and doing all of those things can help achieve the product revenue goals, if they have those goals at all, and how those product revenue goals play with the founder's personal goals, right? Mm-hmm. How's it going to help the founder achieve what they're set out to achieve with building this product? Because it's not just built there for, you know, to give away for free, right? They do want to make a living out of it. So what's the founder's personal goals as well? So can you give us the high level overview what we'll be talking about today?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing that's nice is whenever you really start to break down what the steps are, they really actually translate to a lot of the steps that happen on the development product side as well. So, you know, the first big step that you do is you've got to really kind of create an overall architecture of what the revenue model looks like, you know, much like you would do with the design flow. And you kind of take a step back, and everything can be assumptive in nature. How does the buyer journey, you know, where does it go from point A to point B? What are all the steps and stages? How are we going to measure that? Then ultimately, how do you create product market fit? Where do you actually, you know, take the product and figure out where you can sell it with the least amount of economic friction? And then ultimately, okay, you've got a model, you got people that are willing to buy. Now, how do we optimize and make that go faster? That's typically the three, you know, big steps that that I see. A lot of people think that they can kind of skip those steps, whether through just hiring salespeople or, you know, in some cases, just raising money and throwing money at it. And in reality, that just takes time to figure it out.
So you've mentioned architecturing and engineering of a revenue model. Can we just set up our pricing based on what our competitors are doing and what we think our potential clients are willing to pay us?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you know, the best thing about, you know, engineering the model is that it can be purely assumptive in nature. You know, I think before you get into the pricing, which pricing is just one component, which would be really late in the funnel, you actually need to really sit down and whiteboard out what does the actual journey look like whenever the client first becomes aware of the challenge that they're having, and you start to educate them, and then, you know, they start to evaluate different criteria. Ultimately, their selection, and then they're buying, and then, you know, what are you doing post-sale to make sure that they get maximum value? You know, that needs to be a very clear defined model with actual defined stages with entrance and exit criteria. It doesn't have to be right. It doesn't have to be perfect in the beginning. But, you know, one of the biggest mistakes that I see is that people don't start to do that and put it into a system like a CRM early enough. And then whenever you do have a win, you can't really find the repeatable pattern. So, you know, it's kind of like, all right, we got a couple of wins, but we really don't know like where, you know, like how it happened, like how do we do it again? And you're going to have lots of losses, but at least if you have lots of losses, you can kind of figure out where clients are falling out of the funnel.
Let's try and make it a little bit more structured and replicable for the founders that are listening to this podcast. Now, so we talked about there are three steps to building and scaling the SaaS revenue. The first one is architecturing of the revenue model. The second one is determining the product market fit. And the third one is accelerating the revenue. So let's start with the first one when we're just in the beginning of building the product. And what are some of the steps to engineer the revenue model?
Yeah. Whenever you want to take a step back and start to engineer the model, I would say that is whenever you sit down and you start to really whiteboard that out. You know, having some assistance from some of your potential clients, either through like a client advisory board or having some advisors, and sit down and say, hey, look, like how do y'all typically buy stuff like this? Like, how would you go about it? And then think about the big key points around, you know, those different steps in their decision-making process. And those become the stages in that revenue model. Ultimately, from there, what you're going to do is try to kind of figure out like who the people are that would be involved. What are those like personas? What do they do? You know, what is their business pain? What is their emotional pain? And then what do you do to solve that? You know, start to kind of create playbooks from there and drive your messaging off of that. But, you know, the overall, you know, revenue model and the architecture behind that is really going to be a well-defined stage criteria at which you can put X amount of opportunities into, and it's going to result in X amount of revenue. It's going to have a conversion time at each stage as well, and it's going to be very formulaic in nature. Those different stages can change over time as you learn those lessons, but it's really important that you know, take a step back, start it just like the whiteboard level. And then once you think you have it right, put it into a CRM, create stages, create criteria for those stages, and then start to do prospecting and running opportunities through that, you know, process and figuring out what's working and what's not, and measure the data.
Let's make it a little bit more practical. For example, we have, let's take a product, a tool for marketing agencies. How would a founder go about creating a revenue model for this product?
First and foremost, are the different people that they're selling to. Probably the most useful thing to do is if you could find, you know, a client that's just passionate about this and wants to kind of work with you on like an advisory level, to grab them for a little bit and just be like, hey, look, like, I want to take a step back. I want to understand, you know, how you would go about making this decision now that you understand what this is. And that will kind of, there'll be a couple, like really three, like maybe three or four key points at which they're making that decision. And ultimately that will become the new stage criteria.
Mm-hmm. I thought that it also should include a little bit more of technical like numbers and actual sales projections maybe. Is that something that a part of this revenue model?
100%. So once you have all the stages set up and you have the overall model built out, each and every stage is going to have its inputs and outputs. So bigger picture, you know, if you have four steps in the stage, you know, a high level conversion, whatever it might be, you know, 20%, 15%, whatever it might be, you need X amount of pipeline to produce, you know, this much amount of revenue. But that's usually where most founders stop. And, you know, a lot of times they say, hey, look, we need higher conversion. And this is where this is going to give you more granularity to where you can actually go in and diagnose and figure out, okay, well, where is it not converting? Where is it falling out of the funnel? And just as important is time in this model. You know, you can do twice as many deals in a year if you reduce your sales cycle in half, right? So in terms of getting a lot more granular and kind of looking at this from a more quantitative standpoint, you need to be measuring two different things here. One is what is the input in terms of the number of opportunities, what is the conversion, and ultimately what is the amount of time between each one of those stages. It's going to be formulaic in nature, but Natalie, typically you will not find that true pattern until you've sold 10 deals through that. And that's probably going to take a very iterative process of cycling 100 opportunities through that.
What are some things that can change that we need to revisit the playbook you've mentioned? What are some things that we need to revisit on a regular basis, be it quarterly or monthly, that can be changing?
Yeah, a lot of it goes into, you know, are you able to meet those metrics within each one of those stages? So, you know, depending upon where you're winning or losing opportunities in that cycle, that's probably where you need to look at it. If you're not getting enough in the funnel in the first place, you probably have a messaging problem, meaning that, you know, what you're putting out there in terms of the problem that you're solving simply isn't resonating with your target persona. So either you have a target persona problem or you have a messaging problem. If it's later or middle of the funnel, maybe you simply are just having challenges executing, and there just needs to be some training around, you know, helping drive the client to the next step or going deeper and actually finding pain and establishing value and really trying to help the client, you know, justify this from an economic standpoint. So that's another thing. Also, you might find that later in opportunities, you know, other people are getting involved that you didn't expect were going to be involved. You know, maybe people in finance, maybe people in purchasing, maybe people in legal, whatever it might be. And you're getting a lot of players involved in your opportunities really late, and it's slowing you down. And so ultimately you need to create some plays or kind of create, round out one of the stages in the process to include those stakeholders in that process.
Are there some metrics, like benchmarks basically, that on average from traffic to request a trial is this, or like request a demo on average this percentage, and then from demo to conversion, this is an average how much SaaS convert, so that we can benchmark ourselves against those average numbers?
All the way from lead to close, if you're doing anything north of 10%, that's probably average. From qualified opportunity, meaning that, you know, it's been a sales accepted lead, to closed, anything north of 20% is looking really solid.
So let's say that our numbers are under 10%. So we would say that that's lagging. For example, from trial or demo to conversion, what would be the areas that we need to look at to potentially try and start solving the problem or identifying where the areas of opportunities are?
whenever you'll go back and look at this model and having it in an actual CRM, you know, you can do something free like HubSpot initially, and looking at the data around those stages and figuring out from trial to close won or close lost in this particular scenario, you know, where they're falling out in the funnel. So is this a thing to where they're requesting trials, but they're not responding, or they're no showing to meetings? You know, that might be a place to look. Is it later in the funnel to where, you know, you're doing a demo, but then they're not acting on the next step? Is it, hey, this is fantastic until they see the price and they look at the proposal and then they run? The way to answer the question, you know, in practice is to diagnose where they're falling out of the funnel, and figuring out where you can get incremental improvements in the conversion that's ultimately leading to that sub 10% number.
What are some tools that we can use to identify those conversion points? Do you have a specific tools that you've been using in your previous companies or you're using with your clients?
I think any, you know, great CRM is going to allow you to do that. I'm actually a pretty big, you know, Salesforce fan. You know, HubSpot's fantastic too, but I would say getting, you know, really specific reports though as well. One of my favorite reports to look at is a stage velocity report. So a stage velocity report is basically have the amount of time, you know, an opportunity spending in each stage. And that's actually going to be a precursor to seeing any sort of close lost in that stage. So before it doesn't convert, you're usually going to see a lag in time. So if you want to kind of get ahead of that, you can start to diagnose your model by running a stage velocity report with all your opportunities, creating a stack ranking, and then you're going to have some sort of rules that you're eventually going to get to where, you know, hey, if an opportunity hasn't moved stages in 30 days, there's something going on there. And then you can proactively start to reach out to the account to figure out where the friction is, and get ahead of that. So lag in time is pretty much always a precursor to, lack of conversion. So that's something that you 100% want to keep your eye on. And, you know, if you don't have a CRM set up, which, you know, I feel like investing in tools early is really important. You can even kind of run this stuff in Excel. You know, it doesn't have to be hyper sophisticated, but, you know, this is the reason why you put this into a model and create stages. So that way you can diagnose whenever something's not working properly.
I find that so many founders get hung up on the tools, and even my husband, he's the founder as well. But when we start talking about some problems or how to fix them, instead of thinking, okay, this is the process and this is what needs to happen in order for us to fix that, his initial idea is like, oh, I know this great tool that we can start using. No, like you start with bare bones. You don't have to have like sophisticated systems. Start with spreadsheet if you are under 10, 20 clients, right? If you are more than that, okay, maybe it's time for you to start investigating that. But at the beginning, don't waste your time researching those tools, because you'll spend this time and in the end, you only have like 10, 20 leads or clients, and then you lost your interest and, you know, you go do something else.
You definitely want to stay lean and mean. So for founders, you know, this... promise this isn't like they're not giving me a commission or anything, but the free version of HubSpot's fantastic. We constantly look for tools to solve our own problems, because that's what we're passionate about and that's what founders are passionate about. And the problem is that tools are meant to augment, not necessarily go in and solve all the time. And you look up and you have four or five tools and it's just you or it's just a handful of people, that becomes somebody's job. Really, really fast. And, you know, I know this from firsthand experience, having a, you know, 5-6 person sales team, not a huge sales team, but not having a full-time resource just to manage the revenue tools is a huge headache, because ultimately you can't keep up the data. And then now you've got great tools, but nobody's following process and you're not able to get the tools to behave the way you want them to. And so now you're just wasting money. So there's a balance between like selecting one that gets the job done. And if it doesn't help you, you do everything, dump it out to Excel and do some down and dirty reports, all the way through like, hey, you know, we've got a decent sized team. you know, we can afford a full-time resource, you know, we're going to get all these things, you know, working correctly. That's kind of a next stage type thing.
So for a small company, you would recommend a free version of HubSpot? And do you mean like their CRM?
Yeah, whenever I work with super early companies, I usually kind of steer more towards HubSpot and early on. And then whenever somebody's, you know, past that, you know, hey, we've got 10 clients, we're a company, we're trying to kind of scale now and grow. I think that's whenever you get a more sophisticated, you know, tool set in there.
So, okay, we just covered the first step, and that's the architecture of the revenue model. Let's move on to the second step and the second stage. What is this?
The next step after you've gone in and you've created this model, and if it's super early, it's going to be assumptive in nature. If you sold a couple of deals, then you've got a better idea how you're going to build that. Now you want to really make sure that you've nailed product market fit, which it's something that you've just intuitively been trying to do all along, but now you're going to be intentional about it. And really the reason why you want to figure this out is you want to figure out a way to you know, optimize your unit economics and really figure out a way to sell what you're selling with the least amount of economic friction.
What's unit economics?
So how much is it costing to sell, you know, one deal at the end of the day? What does that look like? You know, how much time and money is that costing you to acquire that customer would be some of the unique economics. So really trying to kind of figure that stuff out.
And if the founder is the one who is doing, for example, manual outreach, how do you calculate the unit economics? Do you add that person's time, the founder's time? Because potentially down the road, if they decide to hire like a salesperson, then they would need to pay the salesperson to do it, right?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it all goes into it. It's their time. It's some of the tools that we talked about, some of the channels, the cost of the channels that they're putting things out there. So, you know, through any sort of, you know, demand gen efforts, whatever that's costing, there's a whole spectrum of things. If you just basically boil it down into, you know, everything that you caught, you know, spent money to acquire that customer, we go into your cost, you know, cost of acquiring customers. The other things that you could look for around your unit economics is, you know, like how many can we do as well within that time frame. That's kind of all those things to look in. But ultimately, what you're really trying to look for is two things. One is just, you know, alignment with, you know, what you're offering and the problem that you say you're solving in the market. Like, is it really the problem that the client says they have or your target persona? And then the other is that, you know, you really want to make sure that, you know, you're going to get lots and lots of feedback on the product, and that never stops, right? And you want to make sure that the feedback that you're getting, that you're able to execute on that. And so, you know, that's why I definitely really steer founders to going as hyper niche as possible initially. And, you know, I think most people are familiar with the term ideal client profile and really kind of figuring out who that ideal client profile is and what it looks like, and getting as granular as possible. So whenever you do start to get those requests, they actually go to a very specific group, and you're able to serve a very specific product group or specific group out there in the market around that.
But it's so hard, and I've talked to many founders, it's so hard to go from broad to narrow because you don't know who your ideal client profile is, and you don't want to exclude those potential customers. And it's so hard to identify, okay, you have two clients from this industry, three clients from that industry, and then three more clients from different industry. So how do you really decide who to go after?
Yeah.
Flip a coin?
in a way, yeah. I mean, it's a great question. And you don't want to be too narrow. You want to get too narrow, but it's an iterative process. You can't just spray it super wide in the beginning because you don't have the resources to execute that. And the other thing is that you're not going to be able to find patterns. I mean, ultimately you're not just building a product, you're creating a business, you're creating a business model, and you're trying to optimize for something. So what you'd want to do is pick a couple of segments of your target market to go after, launch them into some sort of cadence with, you know, with your demand generation efforts, and then measure the wins and losses. Figure out, you know, which one, where are you winning fast, you know, where are you losing fast, and then keep the ones that are working, but what you'll want to do is just in a very iterative nature, trickle in a couple more of those areas of, you know, a new target market, you know, on a monthly basis. Say, hey, look, you know, we're really great at, you know, hospitality companies that are in the Northeast that are using these legacy technologies. You know, we found a pattern here. Okay, like, let's see if the same pattern works in a different geo. Okay, let's throw some more in there. You want to kind of let the experiment run its course for a couple of weeks, you know, or depending upon the sales cycle, it might be a couple months sometimes. Measure that information, see where the wins and losses are, keep the wins, you know, say, hey, the losses, you know, they're, you know, something's not resonating here, and then just keep adding to the experiment on that, you know, quarterly or monthly or every other week. But you just want to make sure that you're adding to the recipe one ingredient at a time. It's maybe the best analogy to say here.
When you're not sure how to decide, so you have, for example, three industries that you want to go after, or maybe five, and you don't know which one to pick first, unfortunately, especially with cold outreach, you cannot go after all three of them, so you would need to choose. So a suggestion here is take a simple table, like a spreadsheet, and the columns, A, B, C, D, E, for example, you put there the attributes that are the most important to you. For example, the first one may be how well do you know the industry? The second one can be how fast is their buying process? Because if it's a nonprofit industry, then their decision processes usually tend to be longer. If it's someone who you can talk to, like the founder, for example, the CEO, you could get them on the conversation, then the buyer's decision can be much faster. Maybe the third one can be how well versed are you in the industry? Do you, and the fourth one can be, do you have any connections there? So think about those things that you can put there as columns, and then your lines can be, you know, those industries, and then just put from 0 to 10 rating for every column, and then in the end you calculate total, and that's your rating gonna be. And hopefully that's going to help you identify which industry to go after is the first step.
As a step further, I would go out and validate that data through client interviews. You know, go out and find some people that will just talk to you about it. And that's usually where those answers come from a lot of times, is, you know, take those different market sectors, go interview 10 clients, potential clients in each one of those areas. Don't sell them anything. Just say, hey, look, you know, I'm working on this particular thing that solves this problem. Love your insight, and see if they'll just kind of tell you, you know, whether or not, you know, it makes sense. You know, ultimately, whenever you kind of get that boiled down to you know, two or three areas, I would 100% formalize a client advisory board, have a minimum of a quarterly cadence to that, and have key people in the market sectors you serve give you direct feedback on the product, and actually have that advisory board get together and talk about things. I was on one a week ago with a product founder, and is actually using Kahoot to run surveys about, you know, specific questions, and you know, getting feedback around like, hey, like what is the biggest challenge you think we're going to have? And you know, as you kind of have these big pivot points around, you know, do you go left or right? Just put it out there and ask them. I mean, they'll tell you. They know better. I mean, they're the ones that are intimately close to the problem, and they can tell you which one's a bigger thing that they're trying to tackle right now, what's top of mind. They'll also tell you what will take longer too.
How do we create a client advisory board? Because in the ideal world, absolutely, that's something that I want to do. But then, how do I encourage those clients to join this board? What's in it for them, basically? Why would they spend their time giving me their feedback about my product that I'm trying to sell to them?
I think the value proposition is really, it allows them to know that you're working on something that they care about. So you have to find unique people that are just passionate about advancing their industry. An area that you can kind of systematically find that a lot of time is finding innovation groups within the market sectors that you're working in. You know, so that's a, you know, people that are actively tasked with finding better ways of doing business are really great people to target about this. The other is that, you know, you're going to tell, you know, give them the opportunity to connect them with peers on a national level, maybe even a global level a lot of times, and say, hey, look, we're all facing a similar challenge. It'd be good to kind of, be a facilitator to where you connect people and talk about, everybody's kind of in a similar role, similar position, similar market, working together, hey, how can we kind of come together for that? And then, the other thing is that, I think most people want the opportunity to, advance their careers and be featured and have a lot of the research and a lot of the things that they're doing be shared with the outside world. And, if you give them a forum to where you say, hey, some of these things that we're working on, we'll give you the opportunity to help speak about these things and, give you the opportunity to put some of this stuff in writing. It's kind of really comes down to the individual and what their personal motivation is. Some people are motivated by networking. Some people are just motivated by, a personal passion for advancing the field they're in. And then some people are motivated by advancing their career. If done really well, it's a really great forum for that. I've seen this done really well, and then I've seen it done poorly. It's definitely something that needs to be run like a regular corporate board. And it needs to have organization and structure, and you need to 100% make sure there's quality there and ready, because the biggest problem that you could have is that if you waste people's time, they're not going to be interested anymore.
What are some other mistakes that you see founders make in this product market fit stage?
This is the absolute biggest mistake, is underestimating the amount of time this takes. So, just dependent upon the product, a lot of founders feel like they've built a fantastic product, which most of the time they have. And then they get ready to bring it to market. And I would say on average, this phase takes about a year, sometimes even 18 months. In my experience, it took that long. Even though it was a very specific product, most founders think that, hey, I built a great product. I'm going to assume my sales cycle is going to take me about this long. I'm going to go out. I'm going to pay for a bunch of ads, SEO, might even hire a couple SDRs. We're going to freaking hit the streets and go, and then we're going to sell our first deal. And then whenever you really start putting this in front of clients, they bring up things that are like, well, hey, look, like there's no way we can move forward with this because it doesn't have X, X, and X. Or, we're already working on this thing here or whatever it might be. There's just so many different layers to this. And it's such an iterative process, and it's probably the most painful process, just being candid. And if you have a way to systematize this and really get ahead of the feedback, then it can be an area to where you start to really build a fantastic product in terms of relevancy. Number one mistake I see here is that pretty much everybody underestimates how long this takes. It's long, it's painful, and there is no way to hack this. You just got to do it, and the only way to do it is just through effort.
I see some founders that are not comfortable doing the cold outreach, the manual reaching out to prospective clients, and they are trying to outsource all of these efforts to someone else because, I'm not a salesperson. I don't know how to do this. Let this be someone else's headache.
Yeah.
It's someone.
Well, 100%. I mean, here's the problem is that you can't. I mean, this is going to be the most valuable learning period out of the whole entire journey. And I would say founders require a lot of coaching in this phase. One thing is that if you create a process around it and a system around it, most product and engineering focused individuals can really get their head wrapped around it a lot quicker and realize that it's not this big overwhelming thing. It's, hey, I execute this many outreach emails a day and it does this. So you're just asking for some feedback, and kind of whenever you start to just get them to just realize it's just a conversation, it becomes a little bit easier. You can't outsource it. I hear over and over again, like, hey, yeah, we actually hired a guy to help us do that, hired a sales guy, but it just ended up being a waste of time. A big mistake that you see is that some people pay big money for somebody, to come in that, like the executive level, like a VP of sales, and come in before they've sold about 10 deals themselves. And like we expect that person to do it, and that person's frustrated because the products are not ready. Founders frustrated because all of a sudden that person is the most expensive thing on the balance sheet. So you just got to get through it. Candidly, most like sales pros probably won't join a company until they know a founder's, gone out and sold 10 or so deals themselves.
So this is the stage where it's not a good idea to hire a sales rep just yet, not yet. So let's make it a little bit more actionable. What would be the step-by-step that founders in this stage would need to do? We talked about, so the first stage was the architecture of the revenue model. We are talking about the product market fit right now. What are the steps that founders should take to successfully complete and move on to the next step?
Step one is defining that target market, whatever it might be. It can be a little bit broader initially, but ultimately you want to get it very narrow. So step one would be defining that, taking, getting granular enough to where you have four or five attributes around it. Location, what technologies are they using? Maybe what's their org structure? You're going to have four or five different things around that. And then even inside of that target count, what are those personas and what do they do? The next thing that I would do is go take that footprint of what that ideal client looks like at that phase and go do two things. One is go create this advisory board, go find representatives of the markets that you're going to serve. First, do some personal interviews with them and talk to them, and then create a form at which you can kind of bring everybody together and ask questions. And then the third thing that you do is you really invest in data around those target markets that you're going to do, and you deploy outreach and demand gen. So, whatever your model is, if it's inbound driven, then, going through that channel. If it's outbound driven, going through that channel, maybe it's a mixture of both, like most people. And then you deploy your messaging out there to that. You measure it for a little bit, figure out the wins and losses, keep the wins, invest more in the wins, and then start to kind of trickle in some additional target market sectors to start to kind of really get it dialed in.
Approximately at what point can we say, all right, we're finally done with this stage and we're moving on to the next stage?
I think it's all dependent, on volume. Some people have a solution to where, you're selling, if you sell three deals a year at, 500K, it's a great year. It's just, in other deals, you need to sell 5,000. So I think it's very iterative. Jason Lemkin, Saster, always says like, hey, you've got to add sold like 10 cold deals, like cold call, like not from friends and family, somebody that didn't know anything about you. You sold 10 cold deals and now they're paying customers.
All right. So let's say that we have at least 10 cold deals closed. What's the next stage?
Yeah, now that you have the model, you've really dialed it down into this data footprint around the ideal client profile. This is kind of the fun phase, right? You get ready to start to figure out ways to accelerate the model. Hey, how do you make it go faster? And, there's a couple of levers at which you can do that. One is you can simply just accelerate or increase the number of opportunities that are going into the funnel. So hey, how do we get more leads? How do we just get more in there? The other is how do we get more just overall throughput, better execution, better training, better process? How do we just get more deals through it faster? Is a really big one as well. One that kind of like goes along with that would be how do we increase the conversion and win rate at each stage? That's usually better training and better process, better messaging, all those things. Another thing as well is, how do we produce more revenue out of this model? Go up market. Increase the price, have a solution that you're delivering more value, you can charge more. Churn can always be an issue, and not just a small issue, but like a make or break type issue. So this would be the phase to where you really want to nail customer success and create a churn proof model. And ideally a way to optimize revenue in this model is not just make it churn proof, but figure out ways to have net positive. To where your customer success team is doing such a fantastic job that clients are continuing to come back to you for more and more, and you're finding additional ways to solve problems for them. I think that's probably the greatest thing about, you know, SaaS, is that customer success can be, you know, the biggest hindrance, and then it can also be the biggest weapon a lot of times. I feel like it's a very underutilized weapon.
Tell us more.
I think we all kind of know how the model works. If you have a leaky bucket that you're trying to put it into, then ultimately your whole model's flawed. So, you know, if every single time you're producing, you know, putting opportunities in and then they're converting at X, but yet on the back end of your subscription business, you're losing more than 10% of that, then you've got a leaky bucket. And so that's a huge problem. But at the same time, just by doing things that make sense, and just having the right attitudes, the right people, just genuinely caring about clients and having systems at which you can stay close to them, you can spend more time with them, you can understand them better, you can treat them better, all those things. And just naturally, they're going to spend more money with you. And this is opportunities to where, you know, you can have additional products you could sell them. It could be some additional services. It also might be a justification of you increasing the price on your product because you've increased so many more features based on their feedback. So, you know, ultimately, I do feel like customer success is definitely the secret weapon in the model.
Increase in pricing, I completely agree with that. We've increased our prices multiple times. The recommendation that I've heard, increase it until people start complaining. And then even then, you don't have to stop. Like if they complain and they sign up, don't stop increasing. So if you can increase the prices and no one's complaining, heck, increase it a little bit more, increase it a little bit more. The first time we increased the prices, I think we more than doubled. And then another 40 to 50% increase. And now we are basically on the same level. So yeah, absolutely underutilized method.
Natalie, one of the first lessons I learned, you know, whenever I was a first time VP of sales, was I pushed back on this hardcore, just scared of doing it. You know, CEO was giving me pressure to do it all the time. We had a product that was already the most expensive in the market. You know, we were having to discount deals early still. And I was like, man, like we freaking increased the price. Like this is going to make everybody's job harder. And so finally, it took me 3 years. I was like, I'm going to increase it by 10%. And nobody even noticed. I mean, nobody even noticed. And you start to realize that, you know, prices is a really odd thing.
Tyler, you've hired, managed, and led sales teams. What are some steps that we should be taking before, during, and after we are hiring our first sales rep?
I would say the step before is making sure you hire the right kind of rep. You know, there is a right kind and wrong kind. I feel like a lot of times people either under hire or over hire. It's probably one of the biggest things that I see. You know, they expect that, you know, hey, we want to go cheap and hire somebody super, super junior. And sometimes that's just extremely challenging because you don't quite have it all figured out yet. And sometimes you hire somebody with bigger company experience, you know, great logos under their belts, and they're used to kind of coming in and just having it all kind of done for them. So, you know, that doesn't work. So really what you need to do is you need to find somebody that just has the right attitude and is like what you probably are as a founder, which is super entrepreneurial, and is really at the end of the day, you know, a business person and an entrepreneur, you know, first, and they're just skill specialty is sales. So somebody that can kind of come in and really complement your skill set, but at the same time, doesn't just want to sell a product. They're passionate about building the business with you. And you know, that's not a seniority thing either. You know, I've seen some younger reps that just have that mentality. And then you got some older reps that have that mentality. It's a mentality thing.
So I would add that before you are ready to hire, you need to be able to generate the leads, and mm-hmm. you can turn them into demos. And you, like we discussed, you need to get at least 10 clients from the cold outreach efforts. You need to have the script, and that script needs to convert clients already. And you have an email automation tool that has already email sequence set up so that even when you don't close a client, but there are still like prospects, there is a automated email sequence that's going to go out to them to help you move them to the next stage. Now, what about the process of hiring? What are some things that we need to have in place or do in order for us to successfully have a few applicants?
It is a sales process, right? And I feel like the effort around recruiting can always be underestimated. It's something that, you know, you have a fast growing company, you're going to be spending at least 50% of your time on. So I think that we are in a fantastic phase right now where we are seeing like LinkedIn become like this incredible superpower. And you need to be making your presence known. You need to be, you know, getting the word out there. And then ultimately you need to be, you know, finding ways to draw the type of talent you want to draw. So whenever you do put that notification out there that says, hey, look, we're hiring our first sales rep or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, you've actually got a form at which you want to do that. So, you know, I think that's probably one of the biggest things is making sure that you're looking through different channels. You know, you've got some peer groups you can be a part of as well. You know, there's lots of different areas to where you can look. You definitely want to make sure that you're looking at lots of different candidates and you're not rushing into that decision. It's a huge decision. I would look at a minimum of 10. And that you're really kind of creating a repeatable criteria at which you're measuring. Now, I don't know what everybody's criteria needs to be, but you need to create some scorecards around, you know, hey, how's this person's sales skills? How's this person's business acumen? You know, all these different components to it. You know, do we feel like they're a really great culture fit and they're, you know, going to be accretive in that nature? And then really kind of pushing through that whole thing. You know, some of the things that are like super tangible that I would look for, you know, outside of, you know, the intangibles, which is just attitude and, you know, does the person have the right, you know, entrepreneurial spirit, would be, have they sold like a similar deal size? Is one that's kind of important. In my opinion, you know, outside of domain and industry knowledge or experience, seniority, I feel like deal size is probably the biggest. Somebody that's used to selling a $1,000 inbound driven 4-day sales cycle thing is simply just going to have a lot of trouble wrapping their head around a 9-month sales cycle. Be candid, I think it's even harder the other way around, to where you have somebody going from, you know, things that are very enterprise nation, you know, in nature, to that really fast, high velocity type motions, and it just doesn't fit. I actually kind of feel like that's a tougher transition. So the number one thing that I would look for, have they sold a similar size offering? And, you know, because usually just that buyer's journey that we talked about is going to match up very similar.
Okay, what about we've picked our candidate, we've hired them. What's the next step?
I would say the biggest thing that I like as it relates to making offers would be make sure that you just like make a very strong offer the first time. Be transparent about exactly where they are in the situation in terms of business. Make everything a very two-way conversation. Let them do their due diligence just as much as you're doing your due diligence. Reference checks, back channel references, all that stuff. But ultimately, whenever you both decide that it's a fit, don't lowball them. That person is really good at what they're doing. And they're bought in and the mission and vision and they want to be a part of building. They're going to be annoyed by that. So, you know, make them a strong offer. Bigger picture, the difference of, you know, 10, 20K, 30K, whatever it might be, isn't that big of a deal whenever somebody can come in and be, you know, very valuable and win deals a lot faster. I mean, you're talking about somebody that's going to come in and be very valuable to the business. So, you know, if you're working underneath that type of constraints, I would consider waiting before you make that offer. So, you know, make a strong offer whenever you are ready to make an offer. But at the same time, though, do a lot of mutual due diligence. Get to know that person really well. Let them get to know you really well. I would do a minimum of 3 interviews, making sure that you really got the right person. And I would go as slow as possible during that phase. But whenever it does come time to make the offer, come strong with the offer, and don't waste a lot of time on that either. Like, make that process pretty fast. Whenever you finally get to the point where you both say, hey, we're ready to figure out what this would look like on paper, make that fast. It doesn't need to last any more than a week, because that's the opportunity where you know it's right, and it's time. And now it's time for you to go close that person.
When you are hiring on site, absolutely taking them for coffee would work great. But a majority of founders would probably be hiring remote help, and for that, do not shy away from calling their previous companies that they worked for or worked with on their LinkedIn profile. So whenever you can find that, you can even ask them for references and then call those references and people and companies and ask, what was their experience? Because I find, and I've hired probably hired more than 200 people remotely and more than 50 people on site. And I tell you that every single time when you do not do that and you think, oh, I love this candidate, there's nothing wrong with them, and then every single time, couple of months into that, you'll realize, my goodness, this is why their previous company, you know, he left his previous company, or they let him go, whatever that person told you about, that may not necessarily be what the actual result was there. So 100%. Do not trust like right away. Do your due diligence for sure.
They're going to give you references, but do your back channel references as well. And keep an open mind. You know, there's always 2 sides to every story, but at the same time though, like, you know, even if somebody left somewhere, it wasn't on their terms, you know, most people have a lot of respect for what they did and they're still going to speak kindly about them. So, you know, you got to kind of look at all those things and realize that, you know, hey, if somebody says something that's like completely like out of line.
So then, next stage is onboarding the new hire, onboarding the salesperson. What are some steps that we can help this person shine, and what do they need from us? Because they're not necessarily going to come and tell you, right? I need this, this, and this. So we would need to have those things ready before we make the hire.
Yeah, 100%. So let's talk about this in the context of it's the first person, and let's talk about it just assuming you're going to go do this 100 more times, because they kind of need to be one and the same. So a lot of times people, you know, founders will do this kind of as a one-off, like, hey, just shadow me, blah, blah, blah. And they don't actually think about it at scale. And then all of a sudden it becomes just a massive drain and a big problem. So, you know, what you want to do, even if it's just down and dirty, creating an Excel, you know, book around it, like create a 3-week plan for that person minimum about every single day about what they're going to be doing. Create some whiteboard sessions around, you know, going in there. I like to kind of teach people about the overall industry and the problem that we're solving first. Spend a lot of time on that. Then teach them about the product second, and teach them about the sales process third. This is when it's really nice to have that overall, playbook put together. Doesn't have to be super sophisticated, but it's going to have your sales process. It's going to have the problem that you solve. It's going to have the different personas, what they do, what their pain points are. It's going to have all those things. I'll tell you a nice little hack here too, is that while you're doing these whiteboard sessions, just take a little webcam and just go ahead and record yourself. Because the best thing that they can do, there's only so much that you can absorb, you know, during the day. It's the person's drinking from the fire hose, and go back and like watch the tape, come back to you with some really specific questions. That's a really nice hack. You know, I would say like this would be kind of in the middle phase, like maybe not your first, but whenever you start to hire a couple, creating a certification program. I know that like sounds super corporate, but I would like to kind of talk about that because it's not something that I did until I had about 10 reps and was actually super insightful, because whenever we got even bigger than that, it gave me a lot of data around it. So creating a certification program, and whenever that individual goes through that onboarding, getting them to take that test, because it doesn't matter. Like, yeah, it matters about the pass fail, but that's not what's important about it. what's important is that you can really understand the areas that they need to be coached. And then you can sit down and create some personal coaching plans for that individual based on the areas they need to improve. So, you know, that certification program was actually the biggest indicator of rep success. You know, it had nothing to do with anything in the interview process. That was the biggest thing. So, you know, I would say do that early. It's actually super insightful.
One thing that I found really helpful is get those sales reps to go through the same sales cycle as your customers would go through, so that first they can understand what the customers go through. And second, they're probably going to come back and tell you all the things that you potentially could improve, because you are, as a founder, maybe even as a tech founder who actually built a product, are blindsided. You've always been doing this that way, and he's going to come and tell you, my goodness, I've never seen that there's this button there. I thought, like, what do I do? What's the next step here? And you'll see all of those potential problems that you just missed, and that all of your customers or leads experience, and you were not aware of that at all.
100%. I mean, Natalie, that's a great point. And I tell you, I've even seen some super smart reps before they join the company will actually do a blind audit, and they'll submit themselves as a lead and see how they're treated and just kind of get a feel for what that looks like. But yeah, that's very insightful.
Tyler, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for all of this insight. Where can listeners find more information about you?
Yeah, so, you know, they can follow me on LinkedIn. That's probably the best place. You know, it's got links to my website as well. But best place to probably find me is going to be on LinkedIn.
Thank you so much. Any other parting final thoughts from you?
Speaking of all the founders out there, hang in there. At the biggest, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the majority about this is just staying alive. And as long as you're growing, it's a subscription model. You know, you're going to grow, you're going to get there, but it's hard. If it wasn't hard, then, you know, everybody would do it. So, you know, hang in there and fight the good fight.
Thanks a lot, Tyler.
All right. Thanks, Natalie. We'll see
you. That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the SaaS Boss Show. If you found this content interesting, I'd really appreciate it if you take just a second to leave a review on iTunes so that founders just like you can learn about this show. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and I'll be back with another interview next week.